Right.
One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
That's beautiful. It's fine. Where I think we're all set. We just. And let me begin then by indicating that today is March 14th, 1995, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Bob Rowland at the CMA offices in Washington. Mr. Rowland, I know you were born in Philadelphia, but I don't know when.
January. No, I was born January 14, 1931. Which makes me 64 years young.
And in Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia.
Tell me something about your parents and your family background.
My mother and father were both Philadelphians. My father was a businessman who was an entrepreneur. I was born, as you can tell, in the Depression. And I have one sibling, an older brother who is a year and a half older than I am, who is John Harry Rowland Jr. And we were born in Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia. My mother's maiden name was McNichol. And her father ran a clothing store, in fact had a chain of clothing stores in Philadelphia called Perryman. And so my father was an entrepreneur. He owned a hardware store. He owned an automobile dealership. He owned a number of apartment houses. And he was a major shareholder in a local bank. And when the Depression hit, as you well know, everything went south. But it was particularly unfortunate for people who had bank shares or were in the ownership or management of banks, because they had to pay back the value of their shares. My father walked into the bank on the day that the president declared a bank holiday and made a deposit. An hour later, that deposit was gone too. So they were bankrupt, needless to say. At that particular time, they had just purchased a house in suburban Philadelphia, out in the western suburbs called Upper Darby, Highland Park. And I was just born at that time. And so my father went to work as a salesman, and he got into, at that time you sold anything you could get your hands on, and thereafter you sold everything. He worked for a very large wholesale distributor's business in Philadelphia called Pierce Phelps, and they're still in business. And he became general sales manager of that company. And there were some really hard times. Hard times in that I remember during the war he would sell dolls. He would sell some kinky kind of, you know, your things you see advertised on TV now. He had been in World War I, so he wasn't called back into World War II. There were some interesting things, though, because he sold some first TV sets. And we always had TV sets and good radios, and the product line, both for refrigerators, white goods, and hard goods, that Pierce Phelps handled was Crosley. And Powell Crosley, who owned the Cincinnati Reds, was quite an entrepreneur in character, and also created the small little automobile. Well, I got to see those little automobiles and drive one of those, went, drove around in one with my father. So that his life was interesting. And he made it interesting for me, maybe by virtue of circumstances. We're Catholic, Roman Catholic, and so whenever there was a school holiday, and the Catholics had school holidays that others didn't get, I would be sent home. My mother didn't work. She stayed home and looked after the boys, and his mother lived with us, my grandmother, maternal grandmother. My mother's mother and father were alive, too, for many years. So there was a good-sized family involved. But when we'd get a holiday, my father would put us in the car, or if not both of us, at least one of us if we wanted to go. And I always wanted to go. And he would take us on his calls to the various dealers. Okay. The net result was that these were small little dealers, mom and pop stores. And most of them had their living quarters upstairs. If they didn't, at the very least, they had some kind of an apartment or kitchen arrangement in the back of the store or in the basement of the store. And if you went to South Philadelphia, it was Italian. If you went to North Philadelphia, it was Jewish. If you went to another neighborhood six blocks over, it was Polish. If you went to another one over here, it was Irish. My father carried a yarmulke in the glove compartment of his car because there were a lot of Orthodox stores that he went to. And he never knew when he was going to be invited to go to a bar mitzvah or something else. And so I got to meet all of these interesting people. And to see selling, not just firsthand, communicating firsthand, but under very difficult circumstances. Because these were people who, you know, they would order a couple of refrigerators, a couple of televisions, a couple of radios, a couple of this, washing machines or something. And then they had to make a quota, and then they would sell against that quota, and then there were all these trips that they'd get to go on. And so I got to see that when I was a kid. And I not only enjoyed meeting all the people and moving around town, but I got to appreciate all of the different, you know, kinds and colors that existed in the city of Philadelphia, which was a delight to me because I had been taken out of the city and transferred to the suburbs, where I saw only one flavor, you know, when I was growing up, by and large, because right. I went to parochial school. So that was interesting. And
was your education then in Upper Darby, not in West Philly?
No, my education was in Philadelphia. I went to grade school at St. Lawrence, which was a parochial school in Upper Darby, in okay. Highland Park. And they were Immaculate Heart nuns that taught there. And, you know, it was your typical neighborhood kind of thing. The school was built contiguous to the church. You know, that you were paraded into the church for the Stations of the Cross on Friday and the other religious ceremonies during the year. The parish house was right across the street. The public school was right next door to the Catholic school. So the public school kids and the Catholic school kids, you know, yelled over the fence and played and fought and threw rocks and all that stuff. The Diocese of Philadelphia was the diocese that we belonged to, and there were no Catholic parochial school high schools until long after I left. In fact, one of the kids I went to school with became the first pastor of the first parochial high school, Bonner, I think it was, which used to be St. Vincent's Home out in Upper Darby. And Dave Duffy, who was one of my neighbors and classmates and buddies, he went out and ran that school. We went in town to school. Went in town to West Philadelphia, and I went to West Catholic High School. And there was transportation right from where I lived. It was a trolley line, high-speed trolley line, Red Arrow.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And the Red Arrow went to 69th Street, which was the main terminus, the end of Philadelphia and the beginning of Upper Darby, the township. And then from there you would take the L in town. Well, nobody did that. We went out and stood on the corner of Westchester Pike, which was the main access from further west down into 69th Street and down into town. There were people who drove by every day for their way to business. We all stood out on the corner and hitchhiked into class. And there was a last trolley that you knew you could get, and there was a last hop that you knew you could get. And you knew who those people were, and you knew the times. And there was a pecking order of seniority. And no matter when you came to the corner, if you were a freshman, you were at the bottom of the line. If you were a senior, you went to the top of the line. So you just hoped that none of the seniors showed up while you were waiting to get there. Because it was, you know, a very anxious thing. I would say that I could count on one hand the number of times that I either missed or was late for class in the 4 years that I went to high school. And that was amazing. Later on, when you got in the senior year, there were some kids that ended up getting cars or having access to their parents' cars, and you'd drive in with them. But that was a very casual, very easygoing thing. Today, I don't think you would see that kind of thing happening. But So I went to West
Philly. West Philly's changed, too, since.
Oh, enormously. and only four blocks over, I guess it was, or three or four, from West Catholic was West Philadelphia High School. Okay. And there was enormous competition, you know, between those two. But West Catholic was big time. It was big time sports. It was a big time school. Christian Brothers ran it. When we won a football game, we were at 49th and Chestnut, and we'd go out to 54th or 56th Street and let the band off and let the team off and let everybody go. And we'd march down the damn street, close off Chestnut Street, you know, or Walnut Street, and all the band and everybody come out on their porch, and that's the way it was. When you had a city high school championship game that was at Shide Park at that time, I mean, you'd get 10, 12,000 people to go out and see, and some of the big ones, 30,000 people would show up to a football game. So it was a very exciting time, and it was a big school again, but a decent education,
Were you involved in athletics?
Yes, I spent a good deal of my time rowing. I loved crew. My uncles were both oarsmen, and my oldest uncle, Babe, he rowed for the Penn AC, and I rowed for Penn AC. And he also rode in the Great Eight of 1928, which was an eight that went around the world and beat everybody. They were world champions from everywhere. And he rode with Jack Kelly and Charlie McIlvain and people like that from Philadelphia. And then when I rode, Jack Jr. was a big star. He was older than I was. But I spent a lot of time down on Boathouse Row, and that was a delight also. That was a good education. I played sporadically at basketball and football and other things, and I liked ice hockey as well. But I would say crew was my favorite sport. I spent about 6, 7, or 8 years rowing, both in high school and in club rowing after that.
Philadelphia must be unusual in that there are so many high school teams. You don't find that too many other places.
There was a huge league, you know, both public and Catholic league, and the competition citywide was very keen and very spirited. I mean, there were a few brawls even back then, but North Catholic High School, I think, was the largest Catholic high school in the country. They had like 3,000 kids or 2,000 kids. It was enormous.
Wow.
Huge, huge plants.
You said your academic preparation was good. Was it rigorous as it might have been in a Catholic school at that time?
Yeah, it was. And I liked school. I always liked reading, and I studying didn't bother me, and I always got good marks. It was just something that came relatively easy to me, and I always enjoyed it. I was always disciplined enough that I realized my brother was the opposite. My brother was a musician and had no interest in scholastics and what have you, and of course he was talented. That was his talent. He could play the piano and he could write music and he could do all that, and he was very clever, so that was a whole different thing. My just inclination was, when it was Friday afternoon and you got off school and you had the whole weekend ahead of you, I did my homework Friday afternoon, Friday night. I didn't have to worry about it from then on. You know, no matter how tempted I was to do something else, I always said, I know I won't do it Sunday night. I don't want to do it Sunday night. The likelihood of my even getting it half right is better if I do it Friday when I'm leaving school than Sunday when I'm going to go back. So that was the kind of attitude I had about, you know, my life, my responsibilities, and school. So I did well. My father was not a college graduate. My mother was not a college graduate either. My mother had gone to girls' school for a while. But they encouraged me, always encouraged me. I did most of the academic stuff on my own or with the teachers that I had. I had good teachers. And West Catholic was a big boys' school. And you had dummies. I went to school with some boys who, by the time we got to our sophomore year, we found out they really couldn't read. And we had those cases. And we had cases of people who couldn't add, who got a bad grade school education for one reason or another, and faked their way through or were passed through. But if you didn't get an education from the Christian Brothers, it was your fault. If you didn't get an education from the nuns, it was your fault. I mean, it was there. And all the help that you ever needed was there, because that's all they did. That's their full-time job. So if you went after class and said, you know, brother, I don't understand what this trigonometry thing is, or I don't understand fractions, and I was always lousy in math, that was my weakest subject, I mean, they'd give you all the time in the world, they'd take you over to the house, they'd put you in a room, and they'd give you assignments, and they'd come back and mark you and work with you. So it was your fault, not theirs, if you didn't get educated. And when I got out of high school, I had a crew scholarship offered to me from Columbia. But I wanted to go to Villanova. I had no great desire to go to New York or to leave town or leave the state. I just enjoyed some of the things. And I liked rowing in the club, and I thought, what the hell, I don't need the scholarship. I can work my way through school and do some other things. And so I decided to stay home and went to Villanova. And enjoyed Villanova immensely. Good school, much smaller then. It was a college, not a university, when I went there. And they didn't have a law school or a med school or a nursing school or any of those things. But I enjoyed it immensely. And when I went there, I took business. That was my inclination. The first 2 years of college were always what you'd call toleration courses anyway. You all got the same crap. It was only after your second year that you picked a major that you were going to focus on. And I picked economics and pre-law, and that's what I did. And I enjoyed college. It was relatively easy. For the last 2 years of college, it wasn't known by many people, but I spent a lot of time marking papers and assisting the professors in the class on constitutional law and economics and some of the other courses. But they had bigger classes then, and the teacher said, I can't grade all these papers and do this, I'll need some help. So they would pick somebody from the class that they thought was good enough that they wouldn't blow the test themselves, but wouldn't, you know, tell anybody what they were doing. And I took all the guys' tests home, and one guy got wise to me, who was the guy that we took turns driving back and forth. And it was only toward a nice fellow, and he was very straightforward about it. He said, you know, it's interesting. I noticed that the only time you carry a big briefcase is after a test. How come that is? He said, are you marking these papers? I said, even if I was, I wouldn't tell you, and you know that. He said, okay, that's interesting.
Let me just back up a moment to high school. Was there anyone who had any particular influence on you during your high school career? You've mentioned your uncles and the rowing and that particular influence.
Not really that jumps out at me. Okay. I mean, I just had a good time. The coaches, you know, the people that I rowed with and hung out with, the teachers at school, I mean, they were just all neat people. There were a lot of characters and a lot of color and a lot of excitement. It was just a good time to be alive, in my opinion, and a thrilling time, because there were always new things. You know, some of the questions you ask about changes and future, and I just can't imagine having been born and lived at a more exciting time than I have. I characterize that by a fellow that worked with me, who has since passed on, but he worked with me over at Paint and Coatings, and his name was Francis Schofield. Francis was a genius. He had a photographic memory. He was well educated. He went to Lehigh and some other places, and Dr. Shorty Long, who was one of the great teachers and innovators in the chemical industry and the coatings industry, polymers and things, said that Francis would have been a millionaire if he wasn't so damn lazy. Somebody had to get up and kick him in the ass every morning to get him started. And that was true. I mean, he'd rather have a drink than, you know, work. But he was a brilliant guy. Francis, when I came down here in 1958, end of 58, Francis Schofield's father worked in the Department of Agriculture. And Francis recounted for me, when he was a small boy, his father taking him across Memorial Bridge to where Arlington Cemetery is now, which was called Meadows over there. to watch a demonstration by the Wright brothers of their new airplane. And they had hoped that this would have some value to government, and one of the big departments of government, the only big department of government then, was agriculture. And they hoped to get some money from agriculture to develop this for crop dusting, or I don't know what they'll have in mind. But Francis also saw the men land and walk on the moon. In that man's lifetime, his living, functioning, sentient, totally aware lifetime went from the Wright brothers to the landing of the moon. Now think about that in that period of years. The history of aviation is like a 50-year period, 60-year period. And I used to hear the statement that 90% of the scientists who have ever lived in the history of the world are alive today. That's not because of a lot of old scientists. It's because the realm of science as we know it is a relatively short period. Yeah, we stand on the shoulders of the Newtons and a lot of other people back here, but this tremendous leapfrogging that has taken place in 50, 60 years, and the impact of World War II, for example, and World War I on accelerating just the industry that we're in, those things always impressed me and excited me. Okay? Now, back to the question. I would say that the first person, there are loads of people that I knew, nuns and priests and Christian brothers and buddies and, you know, parents of my friends, and our parents always took us with them. I mean, when we grew up in the Depression, you know, the idea of my father coming home on a Saturday and saying, "I'm not working today, we're going to clean out the garage, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that." And he was a great handyman, okay? And when the hardware store went bankrupt, half the stock of the hardware store was in the basement of the house, so he had every tool known to man available to him. And when we were finished, you know, at noontime, you know, my mother went out and went up to the little shopping area where we lived. Well, there was a butcher shop, and there was a grocery store, and there was a drug store, and there was, you know, all these little specialty stores, and there was a dry cleaner, and there was a gas station, and there was a bar and everything. Well, the biggest thing for me was when my father would say, "Well, no lunch here at home, we're going to go up to Busty's Cafe and get a hamburger." He'd have a beer and a hamburger, and I'd get a sip of the beer, and I'd have a hamburger in the bar with all the neighborhood guys and everything. And it was not that it was so attractive to be drinking, but you were just there in a social center and watching all these, you know, larger-than-life characters and what went on. I didn't find it, as some people say, well, you know, that leads you down the road to hanging out in bars. I found it more an experience of life as to how to deal with these things. And my father always took me wherever he would go, wherever I wanted to go. And so I understood these things, they were experiences, and I enjoyed them. I will say that all the way up until law school, and, you know, the first time I really sweated, you know, was I going to be good enough and am I good enough, was in law school. I mean, I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and I got accepted on my own and graduated on my own and made the bar the first time out. So that was hard work. But again, I did well, did very well, and wrote the gouge for a number of, joined a law club, and I did the gouge on two or three subjects down there, which meant I wrote the notes that the club sold to other people to study for their exams from, and I learned some lessons from that. But that was the first experience where I would say I met a most unforgettable character, and that was Dean Jefferson B. Fordham, who was the dean of the law school then. Jeff Fordham came from Michigan, and he also had been down in North Carolina. He was a Carolinian. He was a consummate Southern gentleman, a handsome man, a handsome fellow, bright as can be. And he elevated, to my way of thinking, you know, the law school and the whole environment there by his style and by his brilliance. He had worked in the SEC under the Truman administration, and he knew Washington. When I was in my first year of law school. The most important thing that can happen to you in your law school career is being chosen to work on the Law Review. The top people from the first year class compete for this on grades and other things. And at the end of my first year of law school, I contracted hepatitis. And I was quite ill and missed a month of school. And when I got well, I went back and went in to see Dean Fordham. And he said, "Bob," he said, "do you think you're going to be able to make it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm sure I can." And he said, "You know, you've missed an awful lot." And I said, "Well, to the degree I can, I've studied and read and what have you." And I was just sick as a dog. I mean, I don't know if you ever had it, but I couldn't stand to eat. I couldn't stand to smell. I couldn't stand to read. I just laid there for the better part of 3 weeks, 4 weeks, until I was able to get up. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what." He said, I'll let you take the exams, and we'll see how that works out. And he said, "If you think there's a problem," he said, "don't feel badly about it. We can always go back and start you over and do this." And I said, "Okay." So I took the exams and I passed everything. And I missed Law Review. Just missed Law Review. And that bothered me no end. But there was nothing I could do about it. He called me into his office right after the exams were posted. And he said, "You did really well." And he said, "I'm pleased. And you ought to be pleased with how well you did." And I said, "Well, thank you." I said, "I appreciate the support you gave me and everything else." He said, "What are you going to do this summer?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to get married this summer and blah, 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 and all that." And that was my intent. But I didn't. And he said, "Well, would you like to work for me?" And I said, "Geez, I'd love to." He said, "Okay." He said, "Here's how much I'll pay you. And you get a desk in the law library where the Law Review people sit." So all the guys that were my best friends who were now Law Review, I was still a peer of theirs. And another fellow, Charlie Buffalino, was from the Buffalino crime family in upper New York or upper Pennsylvania, upstate. Charlie was also selected to work with Jeff Fordham. And he was a very bright guy. Charlie was very bright. So